Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, CEO and founder of the International Culinary Center, which some of you might remember as the French Culinary Institute. And today on Chef's Story at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, I am so excited to welcome a truly handsome man, but an incredibly talented chef as well. I had to sneak that in, Paul. Paul LeBrant. Paul, as you probably know, is the extraordinarily exciting and talented chef of Corton in New York City, down on West Broadway. But he also, one of his more exciting ventures in the last year, or should I say 10 years, is a movie was done chronicling his time in the kitchen. For the last 10 years, there was a filmmaker watching him, and the film itself is has come out, and it's come out on DVD. It's called A Matter of Taste, and the BBC is picking it up. It's been on HBO here, and it's something we'll be talking about a little later. For those of you who might not know Paul, he was one of the 2009 Best New Chefs named by Food & Wine magazine. His restaurant Corton was nominated as Best New Restaurant in the United States by the James Beard Foundation. And he's presently working on a book that's going to come out this year. So we got lots to talk about. Welcome. Okay. Welcome, Paul. How are you?
Very well. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Good. Good. So you have a little bit of an accent, and it's not Brooklyn. Roberta is here.
No, no.
And I understand that you grew up in London.
I did,
and,
yes.
Did you always dream of being a chef?
Actually, no. My journey into the food world was very unexpected. Nothing in my family have had anything to ever do with the hospitality industry. I was going to go into the military, following my father's footsteps, British military. Mm. 15 years old, went to the recruitment office, sat down, did all the paperwork, aptitude tests, etc. Got to the final test with the CO, and they put a six-year contract in front of me. And I thought, I'll be 21 by the time I get out. That's too old. I can't. So I don't know why. I just felt food was something I was intrigued by, curiosity. Where I grew up in London, I grew up dead central London, which was right opposite Chinatown, or the one street, which is Chinatown in London. But, you know, they had the ducks in the window and the dim sum and that kind of thing. And I used to walk past it when I was a kid, and it was stuck in my mind. Like, that's something which it speaks to me.
Were your family good cooks? Did you eat well?
My mother was a good cook, but they separated when I was very young. So, you know, I didn't really grow up with like home cooked dinners. I went to boarding school from seven.
Yeah, what was the food like there?
Well, if you see the movie, I think I sum it up pretty well as it was like a Siberian gulag. It was pretty bad, but that was, you know, British boarding school food. Mm-hmm. So I did not grow up with fresh, beautiful ingredients. This was London in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had no rhyme or reason to go into being a chef or have anything to do with the food industry whatsoever.
So what was it about the food industry that appealed to you? Yeah. Aside from the ducks in a row.
I don't know. I why does anybody have anything? Unless you are forced into doing something because your family does it. Mm. I don't know. It was an interest. Something that just caught my eye.
So where was the first place you went?
To work?
No. So did you go to school for it?
Well, you know, in England, it's a little different than it is in this country. Mm-hmm. As far as formal qualifications. Mm-hmm. There isn't a CIA or an International Culinary Center or something like that in mm-hmm. England. You know, mm-hmm. it's regional. So mm-hmm. catering college, as it's called, is to get the formal examinations. But I went at 15 years old and left home and started working in a restaurant in London called L'Escargot, which was a one-star Michelin restaurant.
Oh my gosh, you just went on the door and to a one-star Michelin, and
they said, I'm right out of secondary school, so mm-hmm. high school, 16 years old. My birthday's in August. I graduated in June, so I was 15. Mm. 10 days after leaving school, I started work. Moved out of the house. Mm. They had a living accommodation, so I think a lot of it
French
was
French chef at L'Escargot.
No, British.
British.
This is a funny thing. There were two chefs there. Mm-hmm. L'Escargot was one of the oldest restaurants in London. It opened in 1927, mm-hmm. like a very big townhouse. So they had a fine dining 20-seat restaurant up top, mm-hmm. and I'd say probably 80 to 100 seat more brasserie like restaurant. Well, I mean, when I say brasserie, it wasn't brasserie food. I mean, it was high end, very very upscale. And so there was two restaurants in the same building, very beautiful, very gorgeous, Victorian style.
Had you ever even seen that kind of food before?
I remember when I was still a boy in school and, reading the Evening Standard and, again, for some reason, reading Faye Meshner's reviews and being drawn to a certain young chef of the time, a Mr. Marco Pierre White, with the blue apron and the hair and just the whole rock star kind of thing. And I just remember seeing pictures and reading and being like, wow, that's...
So how old were you when you went to work for Marco Pierre?
I was at L'Escargot 2.5 years, so 17 and a half.
17, and what was
like? Just shy of 18.
All right, so I don't know him, but, vision is he's really out there.
When I worked for him, that's when he had just moved his restaurant to the restaurant space at the Hyde Park Hotel, which is now the Mandarin Oriental. Mm-hmm. Most people think that iconic book White Heat, mm-hmm. the Bob Carlos Clark pictures with the black and white with the hair, and mm-hmm. that's what really set him as the image of him for those that were not in England, mm-hmm. and that was before my time. I never worked with that, but that's what I saw. I bought the book, it intrigued me. I'm like, that's what I want to do, mm-hmm. that's who I want to be, mm-hmm. so I went to work at the restaurant, and we were there, and we got the third Michelin star when I was there, and it was a very tough working environment, but it was fantastic in a way.
So
that
explain
it was
tough, because Andre Sultner was here talking about tough pre-war.
Yeah,
what was it like in 1980s when you were doing that?
Oh, no, I'm not that old.
No, okay, 1990. I am. So that's why I get them all mixed up, all those decades, 90s.
This is like 94, 95, 96, around that time.
Okay.
I'm only 35.
Oh, my God. A baby.
I've been cooking 20 years, though, so,
that's
amazing. My youth belies my experience.
I thought you were older. Not that you look older, but...
Thank you, Dorothy.
Yeah, you've made such waves already. So, tell us.
Honestly, when I say tough, I mean... tough in a sense that as a teenager living outside of home, you've moved out, you're living an adult life, mm-hmm. working in the hardest kitchen in England at that time.
So what makes it hard?
Hard. The hours. Mm-hmm. I'm talking 18 hours a day.
18?
Oh, yes. 6 days a week. Very high pressure environment because of the personalities that are involved, mm-hmm. the standards, mm-hmm. the attention to detail, mm-hmm. the rigor, and just the general French sort of way of brigade system, of the way it was, where it was very, you've got to like almost kill yourself to work up. Mm-hmm. You've got to prove yourself, and then the new guy comes in, then you go up a ladder, and that way of mm-hmm. working. And physically demanding. I mean, really hard. Pushing every day. Moment even before you walk in the door, your heart's racing. We used to take things home with us, like potatoes, and turn them at home. So when we would come into the kitchen, we'd at least be ahead.
What inside you made you tolerate that or embrace it the way you did?
My father was a very hard taskmaster. Let's just say that. He was brought up in Rhodesia in the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. He went into the military and he fought a war in Rhodesia. That was the insurgency, which mm-hmm. is now the government of Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. he was in the British Special Forces. So the best of the best of the best of all military. That was the mentality that he had. You know, he instilled in me that if you want to do something at the very best, you've got to aim for the very best. And you've got to give more than the next guy next to you. So for me, it was, I want to go into the Special Forces of Kitchens, which at that time was Mark Up Your White's Kitchen. It was the best. It was
and
the
kitchens
hardest.
Are very much set up like a military command, aren't they?
Exactly. And so that was, for me, what I wanted to do and what I thought, well, if I'm not going to actually go into the military, then this, my love of food and that military-like discipline and that rigor, I can combine both.
So what did you take out of that kitchen? What did you learn most?
I think the tenacity and the sense of... I think a sense of doing the job and doing it well. Like, there's a pride in doing that. It's not just doing the job. It's doing something where there's a ebb and flow in the kitchen, as most chefs will tell you. But to do something where you can walk away at the end of the day and be really proud of who you work for, why you're doing it. And it's not about the money. It's not about that at all. But a sense of accomplishment for me was huge. A sense of learning where it's tough when you're in there and you sometimes can't see the forest from the trees. But when you look back and you look and you realize how much you've grown as a person, your skill set as a person, and the maturity, how it matures you, especially as a young boy like I was when I went in there. And then you look at other people next to you who maybe haven't done that. In comparable restaurants, and you see the difference. And so for me, it was that sense of accomplishment of saying, well, I feel like, yes, I'm giving a lot, but I'm also getting a lot back.
So how long did you stay there?
2 years.
And then where could you go after a place like
well,
that?
Well, you know, as I was getting older...
Now you're old, 19? What are you?
Well, you know, at 19, 4 years of cooking, and not just cooking, but, you know, in that level... I went to work at Pied a Terre with Richard Neat, who had worked for Marco at Harvey's and Le Manoir, etc. Because I had...
Did Marco arrange that for you?
No. As with most things, at that particular time, it was, you know, a phone call. You know the sous chef there, and you phone them up and said, look, I've done my time here. I want to learn more. He had done a lot of time with Robuchon in Paris.
And he's a fish chef, isn't he, primarily?
No.
Okay.
No. That was at Pied a Terre.
Oh, okay.
Which he was the original.
Oh,
he was the original chef, the chef owner, him and, and David Moore. And so his style, I went for lunch there with another colleague of mine who I was working with. And the style was very different to Marco. Marco was very robust, like beautiful flavors, but very, very classic. You know, beautifully executed piece of protein, vegetable sauce. Richard was beautiful, artistic, really interesting combinations. Still very French, but great. Techniques that I hadn't done, so I wanted to go see that.
When you say still very French, what makes it French? He was English, working in London?
He was English, but he had done 4 years in Paris.
Paris. So is it a style? Is it a way of plating? Is it the herbs that you use? Or?
I think it's a combination of everything. You know, when I went to Paris to work, when I'd done my time in London and England, should I say, just being immersed in the French culture, there's the style, the approach to food, the whole mentality was very different to London. So for me, it was a big eye-opener.
Okay, so we're going to take a stop here.
Yep.
And when we return, we're going to Paris.
Fantastic.
You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, our guest is Paulie Brent from Corton Restaurant in New York City. We've just finished with him working in London. And before we go to Paris, Paul, you worked at, I think, one of the great restaurant manor houses in the world. In fact, I had my wedding luncheon there. The Manoir Quatre Saisons.
Fantastic.
In Oxfordshire.
Raymond, yes.
Yes, Raymond Blanc.
Arby,
so
as we call it.
Please tell me the magic. How does the magic come out of that kitchen?
Well, after working in London, I wanted to work outside of London. And it's in Oxford, well, Great Milton, outside of Oxford. So it was my first time working outside of London. And it's an institution. In England, there's probably two restaurants at that time which could be considered the sort of stable training grounds for every Michelin star chef in England. That was Gavroche or Le Manoir. Gavroche didn't really inspire me so much because it was very classical. But Le Manoir, Raymond's approach, fantastic. So going there was a really nice eye-opener for outside of city living, outside of city cooking. And seeing the kitchen that, you know, I'm standing on the stove and thinking, well, Marco Pio White stood here 15 years ago. And name any other chef. They've all stood where I'm standing. And so that was a real treat to see. And the gardens that are there growing amazing vegetables and herbs and flowers and fruits is incredible. Really, really wonderful to see. Very natural, which obviously in the middle of London we never saw. So,
but you still felt like you had to make the bridge and go to Paris itself.
Well, at that time, this is a little bit before Spain became like the culinary mecca, as it were, of like creativity. Mm-hmm. Or now the Nordic region is now. But that was still when, you know, going in England, it was considered that if you went to France, and especially Paris, that was the finishing school. That was like, if you made that trip, and that was like, not everyone did it. So years earlier, like, I had written letters all over France to like every 2- and 3-star place, like, I want to come work or what for free, I don't care. I never got any response from anybody. Maybe it was my French writing. Maybe they're read of like, what is this gobbledygook? But I had a friend of a friend who knew Pierre Gagnaire, who had worked for Pierre Gagnaire and was doing some work in London. And just through, you know, as these things happen, a mutual, I want to work there. And they said, okay. So he got me on the phone with his chef de cuisine and said, you speak French? I said, on pour a little bit. And so I jumped on the Eurostar, went over there, and I worked there for a year.
So did they find you accommodation?
No.
So you had to find your accommodation.
I didn't get paid. No.
Down and out in Paris, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, what's the difference between cooking French food with a Raymond Blanc in England and cooking French food with, well, Pierre has a different style. But what makes French food French? That's what I'm trying to get. And why is it important?
Again, I think it's not, what I found, like when I went to Paris, the hardest part wasn't the cooking. I knew how to cook. It was a language barrier. I didn't speak French fluently. I didn't understand French fluently. So I'm in the kitchen, and the frustrating thing for them and for me as well was, just as with everything in life, is that connection. Once that connection's made, you can do the job, and you can do it very well. But that was the hardest part. So for me, it wasn't so much the cooking part of it. It was more to do with being immersed in the culture and the mentality of the approach, and just the way of doing things was very different.
Can you give us an example of different kinds of approach that you would have in London towards a carrot or a soup, and how they would do it in Paris, and how it would be different?
You are speaking about the one guy in France who didn't approach like anyone approaches food, and that's why I think he has been the biggest influence on me more than any other chef. Even though we were in Paris working with Pierre, his style of cuisine, his approach to it, it could have been anywhere in the world. It was not traditional French, even though it was very rooted in traditional French style technique. But there was a lot of things that we did which were very similar. But with Pierre, it was that masterful balance of using ingredients and techniques that weren't necessarily just French, but framing them in a French way, which was really...
Can you describe a dish?
Mind-blowing. you know, he's famous for a lot of different things. I think one of the first ones that I saw was the langoustine dish that he did, which was dressing the langoustine in six different preparations of langoustine, where it would be each one, obviously it was its own dish, but it would be, you know, a roasted variety, a tartare, a royale, a little gelée, a soup, but all, so it gives you like a little story of the langoustine, which, I mean, I had done that, but not all at once, not like that. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, their use of, you know, green mango and hazelnut with a little gelée consommé of the langoustine with a cream of langoustine in the very bottom. Mm-hmm. A grilled langoustine with lentils that have been glazed in like a really beautiful like tamari soy with little pieces of bok choy and shiso with just the grilled langoustine sitting in the middle. Like this wonderful play of flavor and texture that wasn't traditional.
It's like a book of short stories.
Exactly.
As opposed to a novel.
Well, yeah. As he says himself, it's the story that we're telling with each dish. Mm. What story am I telling to my customer? Mm. What do I want them to read? And that was the art and the genius of it.
So what made you come to the States?
You know, the funny thing is I never thought of myself ever coming to this country, ever, ever. When I was a boy, I was working in London. I was like, I have no interest in going to the United States ever. Mm-hmm. But funny how life is, the first job I ever had, well, I was on a summer break in school when I was still at like a boarding school. I must have been 13 or something, mm-hmm. as a dishwasher to earn some pocket money. Mm-hmm. The restaurant was called New York, New York.
New York, New York.
Yeah, right off Leicester Square. Funny, I look back now, but it's kind of telling, I suppose, right? Mm-hmm. But it was after coming back from Paris. I came back to London, and I was 23. Mm-hmm. And so I'm standing there, and where do I work now? After seeing what I've seen for the past year, looking at London felt kind of boring because there was no one even close. Mm. So I wanted a challenge. I wanted to see new things. Mm-hmm. So I came to New York for a week on vacation. And I just was like like falling in love with a woman. I was just, wow, done. That was it. I'm captivated.
So you had no idea really what New York, or was it the food scene in New York, or
well,
just New York?
I mean, you know, I opened Vong in London very mm-hmm. briefly with Jean-Georges. Mm-hmm. I was only there 2 months, and that gave me a little taste. And I remember like, wow, this guy's amazing. That's, mm-hmm. that's a chef. Because mm-hmm. he didn't look like a chef. He looked like a rock star. He looked yeah. like a movie star. You know, and so that kind of gave me a little inkling. And I guess that kind of smoldered in the back of my mind for a few years. Mm-hmm. And coming to New York, you know, I had a little list of where I wanted to eat. And that's when L'Espanasse, when Gray was at L'Espanasse.
Oh, yeah.
And so I came for a week and I ate as, you know, most to save my pennies, ate mm-hmm. everywhere. And the food, the direction here, the food, it just was fantastic. It was like going to Pierre Gagnaire again, because there wasn't that sort of very confines of like French food has to be cooked in a very certain way.
Formulae.
Exactly. There was this big melting pot of Asian and French and mm-hmm. Italian and Spanish. And
So where was your first real job in New York?
Well, when I came here, I got a visa to come here, obviously, and I went to Boulay.
Glad to hear you're legal. I've heard so many chefs tell the other story.
I went to Boulay.
Oh. Oh, David's great.
And I worked there for 7 months, and then he fired me.
David's great.
I'm in good company, because I hear there are one or two other four-star chefs that got fired as well. Yeah. So I'm in good company, uh-huh. Craig Charlton and Eric and what have you. So anyway, long story short, that was my first job. And then after that, my first kitchen was at Atlas, like
oh,
a few months.
So you became the
yeah,
chef?
Yeah, I would never run my own kitchen.
Uh-huh.
So I was the sous chef at Boulay. I got fired. I spent a few months. I did, you know, a little restaurant here or there, but not like a real kitchen. And then summer of 2000, this restaurant called Atlas on Central Park South, mm-hmm. they needed a chef. And through a meeting of a meeting of a friend of a friend, I went up, I met with them, I did a lunch for them, and that was it, done. I got the job, and I'm like, oh.
Okay, now...
I'm my own chef now.
Your own chef, so I don't know
how many people... And I was 24 years old.
Understand this, a young chef, and you made waves there, because you did very distinctive cooking.
Yeah, I mean,
how did you find this
pre-Alinea, pre-WD, pre-all of them.
Exactly. The New York Times took notice, everyone took notice. How did you find your voice? This is, you know, a chef really has to be the leader of a movement. And to run a good kitchen, you have to have a strong voice because you have all those people following. How did you find your voice? Did you know you wanted to express something? How did it come down?
Yes. I mean, I'm a creative sort by nature. I'm very curious by nature. But I was very young and naive and very energetic. And so I just went to it. And I knew how to cook. I didn't necessarily know so well how to run a kitchen from a management perspective. But you've got to start somewhere. You have to do it. You got to roll your sleeves up and dive into it, which is what I did. Very daunting, very scary. But finding my voice, I still don't think I found my voice. I think I'm still finding my voice as a chef and as an individual. I think you never stop. You never stop learning. So
what was the scariest thing, becoming the chef in that?
The responsibility of, like, now it's you're responsible for not just what you're doing, but you're responsible for everything. You've got to now embrace what is given to you and make it yours. And you have other people that come to you and they put their careers in your hands. And it's your job and your responsibility to take that career and shape it and send them off, because they'll eventually move on, in the best way you can to prepare them like it was done for me. And that's a very scary thing when it's your first time and you have no experience of doing it.
Your day, how much of it is management versus cooking?
I try to still touch all the food every day.
No, I mean in that first job.
Oh, in the first job, it was cooking because we were so short-staffed. In the beginning, there was Atlas, it was myself plus three.
My gosh.
That was it.
And how many seats in the kitchen? In the dining room?
68.
68. So how many covers a night would you do?
This wasn't like a Brooklyn Fare or a Co. where it was, you know, very manageable. No, this was, 64 seats. And we do dinner six nights a week. And there was, obviously, I went there and no one knew who I was because I was a brand new on the scene. So everybody left the kitchen. So it was myself and a couple of people that had worked with me at Boulay and Jean-Georges and what have you, and came to work for me, and that was it. And we just worked ourselves all day. I used to sleep on the banquette after service, and just, I didn't bother going home for like a month. I would just sleep, well, not for a month, for like a week, and sleep on the bank and get up the next morning and make a cup of tea.
And
yeah, because we couldn't get any staff at that time, because who wants to go work for an unknown?
Right?
You know, people, young students generally want to work for a name because it's good for the resume, it's good for.
So when did you start attracting young cooks?
I would say, you know, once we'd been there, you know, like 9 months, that kind of thing, we started to really...
Because you got good reviews.
People start to find out who you are.
Right.
You know, they know who you are.
Right. So then how did you make the leap to Corton? How long did that take?
You know, I'd done a couple of restaurants in between Atlas and Corton. And Corton was 2008 we opened. October of 2008, and through, you know, friends of ours, the space was available. My business partner there had the space. We had mutual investors, and you know, I'm an owner of Corton, so we partnered up, and we opened. You know, there wasn't any big grand scheme or anything. It was, you know, the world was sort of falling apart from an economic point of view.
Yes,
yeah.
In 2000.
We opened, I think it was like 5 days or something after Lehman like went under, and it was very, very, very scary. But restaurants built, we're on our way, we open. I mean,
right. What was the first week like? How many people came in?
Actually, I mean, the first week was fine. I mean, you know, given what was going on, it's a new restaurant. People are still going to go out and to a new restaurant.
It's probably the best time to open the restaurant.
No, I honestly, I think the timing was, as with everything, it got delayed because of, you know, construction in New York City is fun.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think, you know, it got delayed so much because we were supposed to open beginning of 08. If we had have opened, we would have been, you know, in a precarious position in 09. But thank God we opened at the end of 08. And it held us over through 09, which was a tough year, I think, for a lot of restaurants.
For a lot, yeah. All right, well, we're going to take another break, and we're going to come back and talk about that movie they made about you. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and my guest today is Paul Liebrand from Corton. And you know what, Paul? I'm going to ask to change chairs right now because I understand you were a DJ. I think you should be on this side of the table.
Yeah.
When was that?
Yeah, you're bringing up a few.
New York? London?
A few skeletons here. Back in London in the early 90s, in my sort of 16, 17, 18, 19, that kind of time. Yeah, I used to DJ sort of semi-professionally.
Oh.
Cook, you know, in the day and at night, and then after work, go and DJ clubs and raves and stuff like that.
You should do that here at some parties.
Yeah.
Do you?
No, I don't.
You ever jump up in those boots?
I've never been invited, but, you know, it's like riding a bicycle. You know, you never forget, right?
So. Okay, James Beard after parties next year. It's going out over the wire. We've found the DJ. Okay, well, let's get back to you. I mean, forget about DJ. You're a movie star now. About the matter of taste. It's a documentary that chronicled you 10 years
yes.
in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Now, this was somebody who was serious about finding your, yes. your life. How did that whole thing come about? And
well,
it's HBO, the, BBC, everybody's
The director and sort of mastermind behind the whole thing is a lady called Sally Rowe, mm-hmm. who I met at Atlas. She was the then girlfriend of my wine director at Atlas, a wonderful gentleman, her now husband, called Ben. And she, you know, just said to me one day, I find what you do very interesting, your approach to food, your style. Can I film you? I said, oh, fine. Stand in the corner and film me. I don't have to do anything. She did. And it just kept on going month after month and year after year and year and year and year. And it just kept going. And I sort of forgot that she was doing anything.
Did she capture the good, the bad, and the ugly?
Everything.
Were you a little
everything.
Nervous some days?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of crazy to look at yourself over a 10-year span in 1 hour. Mm. In a movie, any of us would look at me like, ooh.
Did you have any editorial control?
I mean, no, it's not my movie. I was merely a subject of it. I didn't make it. I didn't produce it, nothing like that. But it was very cathartic in a way to look back about over a space of 10 years to look at yourself. And she filmed Good, Bad, the opening of Corton, my personal life, and it's not really the story of a chef. It's not a cooking movie. It's really the story of just a young person in this modern age. Ups and downs of living life. It happens that I cook. That's all. And so she was the one.
Who do you think should see this film?
The students at the International Culinary Center.
Yes, well, we're going to do that. And you're going to come and do the Q&A.
I think it's a really good story for any young person anywhere in the world, because there are so many similarities in everyone's lives, no matter what profession
not
you're in.
Not just cooks, anybody
any
starting
profession,
out.
Uh-huh. Any profession uh-huh. that you can relate to. And this movie, I've been blessed and had the fortune to travel around the world mm-hmm. with this movie and going to Brazil, Poland, Norway, and seeing the reaction from people that don't speak English. It's not the native culture of them, necessarily from a food point of view, and yet everybody finds something which they can relate to, and it's very interesting to see.
How can our listeners access the film?
Well, it was on HBO all of last year. They just took it off HBO, and it got released on DVD in the US last week. Mm-hmm. So you can buy it through Amazon, and iTunes has it.
Netflix?
Yes, Netflix has it, iTunes has it, and it's getting released Europe in August, I believe.
Fabulous. Okay. Yeah. And so do you have a desire to do more film? Did that bite a bug with you?
I don't know if I want to do another 10-year stretch of something. As people would ask me, like, was it uncomfortable? I'm saying, well, after the first 5 years, I kind of warmed up a little bit, and then it was easy. Now, I would love the opportunity to do something, because at this point in my life, I'm very different than when, let's say, the movie started.
Right.
So
they have to do a sequel.
I don't know if she'd want to do a 10-year sequel, but...
One year.
You never know.
Right. Every 10 years, one year. But you're also doing a book.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
So we've been working on this for about 2 years, and this is it's going to be written with Andrew Friedman and Evan Sung doing the photography, published by Clarkson Potter, and it's coming out next spring.
Oh, in 2013.
Yes.
And so what's the thrust of the book?
It's not a traditional cookbook, I'll say that. It's it's sort of this a story of my career in many ways, and then where coming from London to Paris to New York, and all in between as well. And then along the way, ingredients, dishes, ideas, things that have stuck with me, and then we've done dishes based on those ideas. So it's not a traditional cookbook of, you know...
No, it's a memoir.
No, it's not. No? There's a lot of narrative, but it doesn't read like a memoir. It doesn't read like that. It's something where you can really engage in it as a reading book, but there's also got, you know, Evan's done an amazing job on the photos. They are beautiful.
Can you give us a photo and an excerpt we can put on the website?
Sure.
That would be great.
Yeah.
That was the... So tell me, you're still so young, 35 years old, and you've done so much. What's the future like for you? What can excite you after doing all of this stuff?
Oh, I mean, I think I'm behind, to be honest with you.
So tell me.
I've always said that. Why? Because Mark Up Your Weight, for example, 32 years old, 3 Michelin stars.
So are 3 Michelin stars appealing to you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
But, you know, the right timing, you know, there's a lot of things that happen with that. So, you know, I think we produce the goods. We'll see if, you know.
Well, that's a full-time effort to go after those stars.
Well,
yeah.
I work full-time.
I know. I'm not questioning.
I'm one of those rare chefs in my kitchen.
You're doing so much else on the side that, you know, so sometimes when you get into that three-star
I get up very early and I work all day, so, you know.
And you love it.
Oh, yeah.
You love what
absolutely,
you do.
Yeah.
Future of food. What is this? Okay, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, all these young chefs made the pilgrimage to France, always had to go in the 3-star Michelins. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in 2000, Spain came on. Now everybody's going to Spain. And then the country of the month right now is the Nordic countries. Mm-hmm. And Rene Redzepi and Noma. Why are we jumping around to all these different cultures and countries? Where, you know, is food abandoned France? Is what made Spain's, you know, the hot spot now the Nordic countries?
I think it's cyclical. I think if you keep going back, you'll always see influence from any part of the world in sort of modern gastronomy. You know, I think when we talk about Spain, there's one man really that put Spain in terms of the modern gastronomic of what we think of Spain. That's Ferran. That's the man that basically was the counterpoint to everything that's been going on in Spain. Even though there was Arzak and before him, he really brought Spain and made that the destination. Now, obviously, the Nordic region with Noma, Rene is the leader there, obviously, has become the sort of focus of the gastronomic world.
But is it strength of their personality or because of something they're doing in their work?
Both.
So what did Ferran do in his work that made every chef want to go there?
He broke the mold.
Of?
Absolutely broke the mold. Before Ferran, which Elbowy was 3-star, obviously, you think of three star as a very traditional French, albeit maybe not so traditional, but very French. He broke them all with how to approach food, commercializing creativity. It's okay to be creative, to think about food as more than just substance, to think about it in a creative art form, the way he's done it, to catalog how to be creative in many ways. It's a very unique approach.
I thought many chefs were creative in pushing the envelope a little on a dish. How was he more creative?
With what he has done, he wasn't just creating new dishes. He's creating new techniques, new ways to do things. The most simple of which we don't even really think right now, is, let's say, the espuma canister, the whipped cream dispenser.
Yes. What did
before,
he do with that?
Before he came along and took it and put a flavored liquid of whatever it is in there and started using that as a device to create new textures and new ways to create a dish, it was used only as whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, well, you can do more than just put cream in there. You can use it to do a hot or cold or whatever you'd like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple thing like that. I say the same thing as someone like Michel Bras, who's another very hugely copied chef in France. That was the first guy to really do the liquid center chocolate cake.
The lava cake?
The coulant au chocolat, which he did in 1981. He invented that dish. Now, tell me one menu anywhere in the world of even the most basic bistro doesn't have something influenced by that. Soft or liquid or but that kind
putting
of
putting those different textures together.
Exactly. But it takes one man to do it. And I think Ferran was the guy who took the idea of being more than just a chef and more than just saying good flavors, but a new way to do something. Very, very, very creative.
Right.
Extremely creative.
Okay, so now, what's René doing?
I think René is really, you know, with Spain, there was a huge shift to being extreme modern. Modernist, where it wasn't really food, it was more about technique driven. René's now shifted the other way, where it's more about the naturalness of food. Very little done to the food.
Have you eaten? Yes,
I have. And it's fantastic. And I had the honor and the privilege of doing a dinner at Corton with him. He came to Corton 2 years ago for Omnivore, and we did a dinner together where I did a dish, he did a dish, and it was fantastic. And just a really reverence for the natural world and for what's around us. And just the things that have been overlooked in centuries, herbs, plants, things that are around us, which used to be used, which aren't used so much anymore.
So is his genius foraging?
Well, I wouldn't say just that. I think it's the whole approach, the whole mentality.
Explain that to me.
Of looking at your surrounding terroir, looking at where you live, and keeping your eyes open for what's around you. Where most chefs, it used to be very much the case of looking and importing this or using from elsewhere, rather than looking so local to where you are.
Does he have amazing technique?
Yeah. I mean, he trained at El Bulli. He trained at French Laundry. I mean, he has all those techniques. They don't necessarily use them quite in the same way that, you know, El Bulli does, where every dish is a very different approach.
So if he takes a piece of Nordic seaweed...
Well, it depends on what he's doing with it.
Right. So it's what he does with it.
Yes.
Not just the fact that he's using a local seaweed no one else uses.
But I think that's the case with most chefs.
Great chefs.
Yeah.
Right. So what's your next...
Mine.
...food foray here?
As far as...
Paul Lebrun, 5 years from now.
5 years from now, I would like to... I wanted to expand what I'm doing, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, with the right opportunities. Looking at Asia quite a lot as far as expansion.
Why Asia and not San Francisco?
I really love Asian cuisine. Mm. I mean, that right there says a lot.
Mm.
I love the Asian mentality, the reverence for food, the reverence for freshness of food.
Mm.
And just that is a market which I think really still embraces the beauty and the sort of the ballet of gastronomy in terms of fine dining. And I think it's a lovely part of the world which I'm so curious about because I haven't explored it that much, but I'm very intrigued by it. You know, so it's for me I would love to be able to look at doing my brand of what I do Asia, whether it be Hong Kong or Tokyo, somewhere like this.
So before we close, I think you have so much, you're so inspirational. There are a lot of aspiring chefs that listen to this program. What piece of philosophy would you give them?
I would say to be in this business, especially the sort of cuisine that I cook and a lot of my counterparts cook, you got to understand it's not 100 meters. It's a marathon. Mm. It's about pacing yourself, and it's about looking at the long, bigger picture. In terms of business, in terms of finding your voice, in terms of creativity, in terms of all of it, you have to pace yourself. You have to understand you can't do it all like that. Mm. That's something which is very important to learn early on.
Well, I feel like we've just done a sprint, and I wish we had time to do a marathon together. Maybe you'll come back.
I'd love to.
This has just been really fun. And
thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening today, and I especially want to thank our great producer, Jack Inslee, and my assistants, Heidi Tickle and Joe Sevier. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.